Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Interpreters and Lawsuit Cost Position. Thank you for tuning in. On May 21, 2012, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Taniguchi v. Con Pacific Saipan Limited. The question in this case was whether the compensation of interpreters, a category of costs that a losing party in a federal lawsuit may be required to reimburse the winning party, includes money paid to translate written documents into English. In an opinion delivered by Justice Alito, the court held by a vote of 6-3 that because an interpreter is ordinarily understood as someone who translates orally, the translation of written documents is not included in the compensation of interpreters. Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Scalia, Kennedy, Thomas, and Kagan joined Justice Alito's opinion. Justice Ginsburg filed a dissenting opinion, which was joined by Justices Breyer and Sotomayor. To discuss the case, we have Philip Fuchillo, who is a visiting professor of law at Michigan State University College of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Fuchillo.
This case concerns 28 U.S.C. Section 1920, which delineates various categories of costs that a prevailing party in federal civil litigation can be awarded. The relevant federal rule of civil procedure here is Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 54D, which authorizes a federal district court to award costs in the first place, and the Supreme Court has determined that Section 1920 has the effect of narrowing district court discretion into these particular categories. Before 1978, Section 1920 contained five discrete categories of costs, and in 1978, a sixth was added by Congress in the form of the Court Interpreters Act, which created subsection 6 of section 1920, and that section provides in relevant part that among the taxable costs that a prevailing party can recover are costs associated with compensation of interpreters. That's the key phrase in the case, quote, compensation of interpreters, end quote. So ultimately, the decision that the court had to resolve was the scope of the term interpreter. Specifically, does the term interpreter cover work of someone who is translating written documents, or does it exclusively mean one who goes about the task of orally translating the spoken word from one language to another? So that was the chief issue in the case. Would the costs in question extend not just to oral translation that interpreters commonly engage in court proceedings? Would it extend even further to the costs associated with a translator's services for translating written documents? And in discovery, it's often the case, as there was in this case, which involved a Japanese plaintiff and a defendant from the Northern Mariana Islands, there was a set of documents that one party needed translation for. And the plaintiff, who ultimately lost by way of summary judgment in this case, in the federal district court received an award of costs, or was taxed costs, for the service of an interpreter slash translator who had interpreted these various written documents. And the plaintiff resisted paying those costs on the grounds that the work of one who interprets or translates written documents is not within the scope of the key phrase compensation of interpreters. So the court went about the task of determining what is the ordinary meaning of the term interpreter by consulting a variety of dictionaries, which were in use at the time that the Court Interpreters Act was passed, which is 1978. So the court looked to dictionaries that we might ordinarily think of when we are trying to decipher the meaning of a term. It looked to the American Heritage Dictionary. It looked to the Scribner-Bantam Dictionary. It looked to the Random House Dictionary, among others. And what these dictionaries seemed to say was that an interpreter is one who translates orally from one language to another. The most notable definition, which the court put particular emphasis on, was the definition set forth in the Oxford English Dictionary of Interpreter, which defined interpreter as one who translates languages, but then indicated that a sense of interpreter was one who translates books or writings, and the Oxford English Dictionary deemed that particular definition as obsolete. So so the court, understanding that the Oxford English Dictionary is one of the most influential dictionaries in terms of defining English words, put particular emphasis on the fact that the emphasis for which the defendants were urging the court to adopt had been described as obsolete by a particularly prominent dictionary. The court also consulted legal dictionaries that had been in use at the time that the statute was passed. Again, that was 1978. And Black's Law Dictionary, defining interpreter as one who translates orally, and the Anderson Dictionary, also emphasizing oral translation as opposed to written translation. One notable exception being the Ballantyne's Law Dictionary, which defined interpreter as one who interprets, particularly one who interprets words written or spoken in a foreign language, and interpret as to translate from a foreign language. One of the dictionaries that presented a problem for the court was the Webster's Third New International Dictionary, and it was on this dictionary that the dissent put its emphasis, which defined interpreter as one that translates, and then ESP for especially, which indicates the most common meaning of the term, especially a person who translates orally for parties conversing in different tongues. So for the dissent, it was clear that the fact that the definition in the Webster's Third contemplates use of the term interpreter as one who translates, and then the definition goes on to describe in particular that an interpreter is a person who translates orally for parties conversing in different tongues. For the dissent, that was notable because it made clear that, at least according to that dictionary, the sense that the defendants were urging of interpreter was perfectly acceptable. And the majority's response to that was, yes, that might be the case, and it might be that despite the Oxford English Dictionary's determination that the definition in question was obsolete, it might be that other dictionaries deem this particular interpretation to be perfectly acceptable, but the majority urged the point of the exercise was not to determine which was an acceptable definition, but which was the common meaning and the common understanding and the most natural understanding of the term. So the court therefore found support for its approach in the fact that the Webster's Third Dictionary used the ESP, meaning especially, to say that an interpreter is one who translates orally. That suggests that according to the Webster's Third, this is indeed the most common meaning. And that, after all, is what the court was on the search for throughout the opinion. So having surveyed the various dictionaries, the court was satisfied that the ordinary or common meaning of interpreter was one who translates orally from one language to another, and therefore did not include one who translates written documents. So on that basis, the court was satisfied that the interpretation or the understanding of compensation of interpreters that the defense was urging in order to receive costs for the services that it had undertaken to translate the various documents, it would not be able to recover those costs under Section 1920, Section 6. And the court spent the rest of its opinion trying to determine whether there was a reason to disregard the most common meaning and perhaps go with an accepted understanding of the term interpreter rather than the most common meaning. And the court determined that there was no reason to do that. One of the things the court did was to consider the statutory context, relying on the canon of statutory construction that says that a term in the same statute should receive an identical meaning throughout, the court decided to look at other provisions of the Court Interpreters Act. The court saw, upon looking through the various other provisions, that the most common understanding that it had determined from the prior analysis was the way that Congress had used the term interpretation throughout the statute. It saw that, again, although the term interpreter might be stretched to include one who translates written documents, there was no sense of that term used in the provisions that it considered of the Court Interpreters Act. They universally seem to suggest that the understanding and the exclusive understanding of the term interpreter was one who translates orally from one language to another. So that provided for the court a contextual clue that confining the term interpreter to one who translates orally as opposed to one who translates writings was the appropriate way of confining the definition. The court also considered references to technical terminology in the Court Interpreters Act and determined from the relevant professional literature that scholars had drawn a line between the term interpreter and the term translator, the former being used for one who translates oral conversations, and the latter, translators, being used in connection with one who interprets or translates written communications. So that just further supported the court's point that the most common understanding of the term interpreter, the one that Congress intended, the one that Congress used throughout the relevant statute, the Court Interpreters Act, and the technical meaning of interpreter all seem to mean the same thing, all seem to find consensus in the description or the definition of interpreter as one who translates orally as opposed to one who translates writings. The court went on to discuss why the lower court, in this case the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, and the dissent were approaching the issue incorrectly. Again, the court emphasized that the dissent was incorrect in believing that the appropriate definition of interpreter was one that was acceptable as opposed to one that was most common. The lower courts, both the Ninth Circuit and the district court in the case, found support for a broader definition of interpreter based upon Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 54D. Again, that's the provision of the federal rules that authorizes district courts to award costs. And the lower courts determined that it was appropriate to give a broader definition in light of the district court's discretion. But the majority's response to that was that this was not the appropriate approach. If anything, the purpose of Section 1920 was to narrow the scope of taxable costs. Indeed, there are a variety of expenses that one incurs in the course of conducting civil litigation, and it's the rare expense that is considered a taxable cost within the meaning of Section 1920. And that was precisely the point of Section 1920, was to reduce the amount of costs, to narrow district court discretion in awarding costs, and therefore keep it to the more minor incidental expenses that one incurs in the course of defending or prosecuting a civil action. And it's often the case that taxable costs are a fraction of the total expenses that one incurs in the course of conducting civil litigation. So it would make perfect sense that Congress would deem it appropriate to confine the term interpreter to a sense that is more narrow, again, limited to one who interprets oral communications as opposed to one who interprets or translates written communications, in order to keep the scope of costs more modest than not. So the court was emphatic that Rule 54D, although authorizing an award of costs by a federal district court, should not be seen as licensing a broader interpretation than Congress would intend. So in this case, given that it was the most common meaning of interpreter, to limit that term to one who translates oral communications rather than to expand it to one who translates written communications, it made perfect sense that Congress would want to keep a more narrow construction, or that Congress would prefer a narrow construction in accord with its intent rather than a more expansive construction, which would have the effect of increasing or expanding the amount of recoverable costs in civil litigation. But that is not the point of Rule 54D, the court made clear. Another aspect of the opinion which was interesting, in response to the dissent suggestion that it's often the case that the cost of translating written documents must be incurred because translation is necessary to conduct the litigation effectively, which seems like a very persuasive argument. If it's the case that a party needs to have documents translated by someone who has the relevant skills to do that, then certainly they should be reimbursed their costs along with other taxable costs if they're receiving any taxable costs at all. But the court was not convinced that this was a reason to expand the definition of interpreter beyond its ordinary meaning. And the court, in this regard, emphasized that it's one thing to have an interpreter available at a court proceeding in order to translate communications for a party in real time. It's another thing to have an interpreter who might have the task of translating an extensive amount of written discovery. Those costs can add up considerably. And again, going back to the idea that taxable costs under Section 1920 were not meant to cover all of the costs, not even close, really intended to cover just a fraction of the costs, given the volume of discovery that many civil actions entail, it wouldn't make sense that Congress, without being more specific, would intend for these kinds of costs to be covered, namely costs of a written translator, especially since many civil actions involve the interpretation of documents or the translation of documents that would often be fairly extensive. One final point that the respondent had made was that distinguishing interpreter as one who translates oral communications versus one who translates written communications is not appropriate because there are various tasks in which interpreters slash translators engage that involves a little of both. You might have hybrid tasks, that is. There are certain services that folks who do this perform that might involve a little of both. For example, it might be that an interpreter is engaging in the exercise of sight translation, which involves the oral translation of a written document. Another task involves written translation of speech. And a third task, which is called document comparison, involves comparing documents in the source and target language to verify that the two are identical. So each of these tasks involves a little of both. It's not quite oral translation exclusively, nor is it quite written translation exclusively. And the court was comforted by the fact that, first of all, in this particular case, we didn't have any of those hybrid services that interpreters slash translators engage in. It was strictly a matter of the translation of written documents. And secondly, it's not like those situations arise all that frequently. So in those cases where they do arise, then district courts can be trusted to assess costs appropriately based upon the understanding of interpreter as an oral translator and not a translator of written documents. So accordingly, the court was satisfied that the most common meaning of the term interpreter was one who translates oral communications from one language to another, thereby rejecting a conception of interpreter that would cover the translation of written documents. And the court saw, after considering statutory context, after considering the history of Section 1920 and its purpose, and after considering policy considerations surrounding the awarding of costs, that there was no need to go beyond the most common meaning of the term interpreter, and that's the one that should be applied. And in future cases, therefore, in federal civil litigation, a party who engages the services of a translator for the purpose of having written documents translated, even documents that are necessary for effective prosecution of the litigation or effective defense of litigation, will have to go about that task with the understanding that whatever is paid to the relevant expert for the services in question will not be among the taxable costs that could be assessed at the end of the litigation if, in fact, that party prevails. So it might be, as it always is the case whenever the court engages in the task of interpreting a term, it might be that Congress amends the statute to expand its scope to include translation of documents in addition to translation of oral communications. But in the meantime, under Section 1920, subsection 6, the translation of written documents will not be a service for which a party can expect to be reimbursed even if they prevail in the civil action.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.